Till Death Do Us Part is a lighthearted and sometimes satirical true crime podcast where we present our dysfunctional married take on serious cases involving other dysfunctional relationships. We hope you enjoy.
Hello, and welcome to the 107th episode of Till Death Do Us Part.
Dang, I'm still Daniel.
And I'm Melissa.
If I'm still alive at 107, I want you to cover me with a pillow.
Oh, I will. I already have plans.
Because at that point, I will be wearing a diaper. I'll be incontinent. I won't know what's going on around me. It'll be horrible.
You might be more fun, actually.
Oh, gosh.
You just cleared your throat on the air.
I'm sorry.
How dare you, sir?
Okay, start over.
With what?
I don't know. Everything. All right, I'm ready.
I'm not starting over.
And we're back.
Oh, goodness. We have not gotten more professional in 107 episodes, that's for sure.
No, it's degraded significantly.
We're still amateurs.
We
apologize.
You've gotten more professional. I have significantly degraded.
Daniel cracks more.
I have. I have, and I am, and I do. Yes.
I'm always spending time editing out pops and cracks.
You know what you should do is just get all the cracks and then put them all together at the very end.
It's a compilation.
Like 30 seconds of all the cracks that you took out.
That would be awful.
It's all.
No. See, just I'm going to have to take some of that out.
Why?
It's grating on the ear hole.
Yeah.
Anything new you want to talk about?
No, not really.
All right, Daniel, you got some factoids for me?
You asked me to do something about people doing crime stuff.
One of our listeners asked you to do that.
Right.
Because she was assuming that all of your factoids were going to be about crime-related incidents. But maybe what she doesn't understand is that you don't particularly care about crime or true crime. So the point of his factoids is like an appetizer, a palate cleanser to get you into, you know, the horrific true crime case that I'm about to tell you.
I guess so. I really have no rhyme or reason to it.
No, he just picks what he likes at that time.
Mm-hmm.
He has to suffer through my cases, and I have to suffer through his factoids. Yeah. It's called marriage.
The very essence of the podcast is crime facts. So I wouldn't think you'd want me to do crime facts before the crime facts.
No, but it's fun to throw it in there. And so I'm giving one of our 11 listeners what they asked for.
Okay, so with that being stated wholeheartedly,
and wasting a lot of time,
I'm going to talk about Bonnie and Clyde.
Yay!
Because most people know who that lovely couple is.
Yeah, and we're going to do a To Have and to Kill with Bonnie and Clyde eventually, so.
Oh, should I not do this?
No, I wasn't going to do it for November's episode, so it's fine.
Okay. Well, you can use some of these facts, I guess.
I can.
A lot of this I got from History Channel.
Okay.
So if anyone wants to yell at me, go ahead, because I'm making all this stuff up anyway.
Daniel's facts aren't even really facts.
No, because they come off the internet.
Right. So don't believe everything you read on the internet, people.
Okay, so Bonnie and Clyde were both born in... Bonnie was born in 1910. Clyde was born in 1909.
So he's a year older than her.
And they were ultimately finally gunned down by law enforcement when in 1934, so they were 23 and 25.
They were that young?
Yes.
I did not realize they were just babies.
Yeah, so I'm just giving a quick overview. Most people know, but if you didn't know, they were just young pups. The height of their kind of violent robbery, all that stuff, was around 1931 to 1934 when it came to an abrupt end. They were kind of known for like bank robberies, but in reality, most of their stuff was like knocking off mom and pop shops. And they said most of the time they didn't get very much because this was the height of the Great Depression. So they were taking like $5 or $10 at a time. At their peak, they murdered 13 people.
Oh, Jeez.
Combined, they did do a couple of kidnappings. So some interesting things about Bonnie and Clyde. Bonnie was married. She never was married to Clyde. She got married to her classmate, sweetheart, Roy Thornton, 6 days before her 16th birthday.
Oh, that's what you did back then, though.
And only a handful of months after their marriage, he went to prison for robbery.
Oh.
And then she never saw him again. So then she met Clyde, and of course, things went downhill from there.
She sure knew how to pick him.
And in the very end, she still had her wedding ring from Roy, even though she died with Clyde. So she was never divorced from Roy, even though she was the famous Bonnie and Clyde dynamic duo.
So she was married at 16 and died in her when early 20s.
23, yeah.
Oh, okay.
She was told by her doctor that she was not genetically capable of having children. So she was pretty upset about that. So I think at that time she's like, well, then what good am I?
Well, you don't have to have kids to
be. No, I'm just saying, back then, so that probably brought her down quite a bit.
Okay.
So yeah, Roy was imprisoned in 1929. And then the fun part is Bonnie had a tattoo of two connected hearts on the inside of her right thigh. And the label was Bonnie and Roy.
Ooh.
That's sexy. Are you going to do one for us?
No.
Like Daniel and Melissa forever? Like no. Hearts on the inside? No. Okay.
No, because my next husband, it might be like a deal breaker.
Well, you could scratch like a line through my name and then tattoo a new name next to it.
Like Johnny Depp did.
Yeah, they just keep scratching out names and adding new names.
He had Winona Forever tattooed on his body, you know, for Winona Ryder.
Right.
And then he changed it, I think because of Amber Heard. He changed it to Wino Forever. That's awesome.
You know what? Good for him. Why not?
Why not?
Interesting fact about Bonnie, she actually wrote poetry. She excelled at creative writing and writing like verses.
Like Bible verses?
No, like poetry. I don't know.
Just teasing. Good for her.
She gave her a poem that she wrote to her mom entitled The Trail's End 2 weeks before her death.
Oh, that's fitting.
And the end of the poem goes, someday they'll go down together.
Oh.
And they'll bury them side by side. To a few, it'll be grief. To the law, a relief. But it's death for Bonnie and Clyde.
She nailed it.
So she wrote that. Then gave it to her mom. 2 weeks later, gunned down by law enforcement.
I wonder if they were buried together or side by side.
They were not, because her mom was so upset, of course, never approved of Clyde. She actually had Bonnie buried far away in, I think it was outside of Dallas, Texas somewhere.
Oh.
And I remember reading. So purposely, the mom buried her far away from Clyde.
I probably would do that too.
So fun fact, they died in a stolen 1934 Ford with a flathead V8 engine, which three people aside from myself listening know what that is. I think it's cool. But anyway, at least 150 bullets were shot into the stolen car.
It's a lot of bullets.
They claim that the coroner officially found 17 entrance wounds on Clyde and 26 on Bonnie.
Didn't she throw her body over his?
I don't know. I didn't read that. But that sounds dramatic. Sure. Absolutely.
Maybe that was in the movie.
Yeah. No, there's been movies. So I purposely did not read any of the movie stuff because it's just going to be, you know, Hollywood.
Mumbo jumbo.
It says they were so mangled that the funeral home had trouble embalming them.
Oh, yeah.
I can imagine. You pour it in one end and it just comes out one of the 17 holes. 26 for her.
Well, Faye Dunaway and Warren Beatty, who played Bonnie and Clyde in the movie, they looked beautiful when they died. So
they weren't a bad looking couple. I mean, for black and white pictures during the Great Depression, I guess.
I don't think they looked like Warren Beatty or Faye Dunaway in real life.
Probably not. Clyde was actually rejected from the Navy. So as a teenager, he tried to enlist in the U.S. Navy. But he had some boyhood illness, they say possibly malaria or yellow fever, and he was rejected medically. And they said he took it really hard because he had already tattooed USN on his left arm in anticipation of getting into the Navy.
Aww.
It sounds like these two actually were trying to like make something of themselves, and then life just kept giving them roadblocks, and finally they're like, you know what, screw it. Let's just rob everything in sight.
Let's just go for it.
Yeah, let's just full on, we'll steal cars, we'll pillage and rob, and that's it. All right, I'm almost done. This is fun for all of you that have just for the slightest minute have rented a car and thought about not bringing it back. Like, what if I just drove off and this thing never came back? Well, Clyde's first arrest came from failing to return a rental car.
They had rental cars back then?
That's what it says on this from the old History Channel thing.
Oh, I wonder how old he was, like 14?
Well, I'll tell you, you can do the maths in your head if you'd like. He was first arrested in 1926. He was born in 1909, so there you go. For automobile theft after failing to return a car he had rented in Dallas to visit an estranged high school girlfriend. The rental car agency actually dropped the charges, but the incident remained on his arrest record.
Does that mean he was 16?
Oh, now you're calling me out. This is 16, 17.
17?
Yep, 17. Can you rent a car at 17? God, I can't do anything. I guess back then. Now. 3 weeks later, he was arrested again alongside his older brother, Ivan, nicknamed Buck Barrow, for an even more ridiculous crime, possession of a truckload of stolen turkeys. So there's that.
Gobble, gobble till you wobble.
I'm going to finish with this. Poor Clyde. Man, this kid. Good Lord. I call him a kid because, you know, he was. He chopped off two of his toes in prison. So then you say, well, when did he go to prison? Right?
That's what I was thinking.
While serving a 14-year sentence in Texas for robbery and automobile theft. In January of 1932, Clyde decided he could no longer endure the unforgiving work and brutal conditions at the notoriously tough East Ham prison farm. In the hopes of forcing a transfer to a less harsh facility, Clyde severed his big toe and a portion of a second toe with an axe. Although it is not known whether he or another prisoner actually were the ones wielding the instrument, the self-mutilation, which permanently crippled his walking and prevented him from wearing shoes while driving, ultimately proved unnecessary as he was released on parole 6 days later anyway. So they were going to let him out anyway, basically early. And meanwhile, he had chopped his toes off.
Well, that's interesting.
So similarly to poor Clyde, I say poor Clyde, he's a horrible kid, right? He killed people. Bonnie actually was also walking with a limp after a car accident. In June of 1933, Clyde, driving with Bonnie in the passenger seat, they were speeding along a rural road of North Texas so quickly that he missed a detour sign warning of a bridge under construction. Their Ford V8 car smashed through a barricade at 70 miles an hour, sailed through the air before landing in a dry riverbed. Scalding acid poured out of the smashed car battery and severely burned Bonnie's right leg, eating away at her flesh down to the bone in some places. As a result of the burns, Bonnie, like Clyde, walked with a pronounced limp for the rest of her life, and she had such difficulty walking that at times she had to hop, and then sometimes Clyde had to carry her.
Really?
So these two were quite a sight.
They were quite a pair.
For those of you that would like to see their actual bullet-riddled car, it's sitting at Whiskey Pete's Casino right when you cross over the state line into Nevada, coming into Vegas.
Okay.
It's inside, on display, covered in holes, blood dripping out of it. No, they've cleaned it.
We saw it.
Yeah. It's beautiful. So there you go. Bonnie it's and beautiful. Clyde. You're welcome.
Daniel.
What?
Are you ready for my case?
Sure.
This is the case of Mark and Julie Jensen. And this was recommended by one of our 11 listeners and Patreoner. Megan B.
Thanks, Megan B.
Thanks, Megan. In the late afternoon on December 3rd, 1998, in the village of Pleasant Prairie, Wisconsin, a man by the name of Mark Jensen dialed 911. He told the operator that his wife, 40-year-old Julie Jensen had been sick for the last few days. After picking their two boys up from school, ages 8 and 3, Mark had walked into the master bedroom to check on Julie, his wife of 14 years, and found her not breathing, and she did not have a pulse.
Was she dead in the bed from a wound from her head?
She was deceased.
Okay.
An ambulance was immediately dispatched to the home on 9020 Lakeshore Drive in the Carroll Beach neighborhood of Kenosha County.
Sounds like a nice area.
I can't say Kenosha without that Wisconsin accent. You just can't. I don't know why. It's like Kenosha.
The Kenosha Kickers?
That's from Home Alone.
Of course it is.
Mr. John Candy.
I love John Candy. I miss him.
I miss him. I didn't know him personally, but I miss him.
I did.
No, sure. Now, this house was a block up from the banks of Lake Michigan. So this was an area, right?
That sounds beautiful.
Yeah, it was a nice area. It was definitely middle to upper class.
You know the problem with that area, though?
What's that?
They have weather.
They have severe weather.
Like real stuff that we've never seen before.
Never been a part of that.
I've never seen real weather.
Not really.
We are spoiled brats.
We are. And that's okay.
Because people I'm fine with that. People from that area are listening to us going, oh yeah, you guys have no idea.
No, we have no idea what you go through every season, to be honest. Investigators were called to the home along with the district attorney, Bob Jamboys.
Jamboys. That's a cool name.
Bob. Hey, Bob.
Bobby Jamboys.
Julie was lying on the bed wearing a pink t-shirt. Her petite body was unnaturally and awkwardly on one of her arms, and half of her face was pushed down into the pillow. So we're going to hear a lot about how her body was placed because it was in such an awkward position. So just imagine you are lying basically on the side of your stomach over your arm, and then your face is kind of into the pillow. That's not a normal or comfortable way to sleep. So no. It almost looked like she was on her back with her arms outstretched and then somebody rolled her over.
Gotcha. Yeah.
Can you picture that in your head? I did see the photos of the crime scene, and I would have said the same thing that these investigators said, which was, this was not a natural pose. This was not a natural way for somebody to be sleeping.
So someone moved her after the fact.
That's what they're saying.
Okay.
39-year-old Mark was questioned at the scene and seemed like a grieving husband. He told investigators that Julie had been depressed and had recently begun taking the antidepressant medication Paxil and the sleep aid Ambien. Mark said that he had made her go to their family physician on December 1st, where she was given the samples of the medication Paxil. After beginning this medication, Mark phoned the doctor and told him that Julie was acting inebriated, jumping on the bed, and that she had not slept. The physician then prescribed Ambien, and Mark picked it up from the pharmacy. So this is all within a couple days before Julie was found deceased.
Okay.
Julie took one of the Ambien, hoping to get some sleep, but instead she became violently sick. She was vomiting and shaking uncontrollably, but Mark never took her to the hospital. It was so bad that Mark stayed home with her that morning, so the morning that her body was found. And after returning home from picking up the boys from school, Mark found Julie dead. Now, my question was, why was she still in the bed? Did he not even try to save her? Like, he didn't touch her at all, didn't touch the scene at all. Just called 911.
And he didn't say that he rolled her to her side.
No, he said he never touched her. But if your wife is on the bed and she looks like maybe she's dead, wouldn't you shake her? Or wouldn't you try CPR or move her onto the floor so that you could do CPR?
Probably.
You wouldn't just walk in and be like, oh, damn, she's dead, and then walk out and call 911.
Now, the first step to giving CPR when you assess a scene is you do not want to move the body. However, they say it's very difficult almost impossible to give CPR to someone laying in a bed. Because if you're doing like chest compressions, not mouth to mouth, but chest compressions, the body could go into the mattress as opposed to the chest compressing. So at that point, you would have to probably move them onto the floor.
But can you give somebody mouth to mouth while they're on their side or almost on their stomach?
Well, I mean, I guess if you could get, if you could position your mouth, I wouldn't think so. I would think you would normally, especially in CPR, you would try and get the person flat on their back. Tilt the chin, open the airway, you know, the normal CPR process.
Right, but this wasn't a stranger. This was his wife. This was the person that he was married to for 14 years.
Yeah.
And he never touched her in that bed. He just said, oh, she's dead.
If it were me coming upon you in bed in that state, yeah, I would absolutely try everything I could.
That's what I was thinking.
Yeah. But it would be easier to do it if you were on your back.
Just like most things.
Well,
in bed.
You know, it depends if you're limber, you know, I don't know.
After questioning Mark, the DA and investigators just were not buying his story. It all seemed a little suspicious. The district attorney, Bob Jambois, had a brilliant idea. They needed Mark's permission to really search that house and its contents. They didn't really want to go get a warrant to search because that took too long. And gotcha. They wanted to get in there and start looking at what was in this house.
Before something could change.
Exactly. Yeah. So he told Mark that they would need to do a death scene evaluation for the life insurance company, which he assumed that Mark had a life insurance policy out on Julie. So could they just do it now?
That was smart.
That was really smart. And Mark agreed. But when Mark was told that the family computer would be taken and analyzed, Mark was then a little apprehensive, but agreed after a few tense minutes. Now, what Bob also said was that this was the first time he had gone into a home where there was a computer, where there was a family computer.
Well, this was in 1998, you said?
1998, yeah. Yes. And he'd never gone into a home where there is a computer just in an office used for the family.
Right. I would say this was kind of at the start of the home computer in every single household kind of thing. But prior to this, a few years prior, that would be very rare.
Exactly. A preliminary autopsy was performed on Julie's body and nothing suspicious was found. So they had no idea how she died. And by February of 1999, the autopsy report said that they were unable to determine a cause of death. And that the blood sample taken from Julie the day that she died came back with nothing unusual.
So she just stopped breathing magically?
Magic. Samples of all Julie's organs, blood, and tissue were taken and saved before Mark could have her cremated, which was against her family's wishes, I might add. The family kept saying Julie would never have wanted to be cremated. And Mark kept saying, oh, no, we talked about it. She said she wanted to be cremated.
Hmm.
So what happened, right?
Mm-hmm.
How did Julie die? Nothing was found in the autopsy. I don't know how many times I can say that. It was not a drug overdose or a fatal drug interaction because they were thinking, well, maybe it was the Paxil and the Ambien that caused her to stop breathing. But she didn't have high levels of Paxil or Ambien. Actually, they could barely find any levels at all.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So what happened, right?
Yeah.
There was no physical injury found to her body either. So something was off. Investigators began digging. Now you got to find out what happened. Mark and Julie grew up in the same town, attended the same schools, but didn't officially begin dating until seeing each other at a party in the summer of 1976. After Mark's graduation, because they were a year off in school.
Gotcha.
So Julie was a year older. But I had also heard that they did not start dating until meeting when they were part-time associates at the local Sears. Do you remember Sears?
Of course. Yeah. Craftsman, Sears. You can get anything at Sears.
I loved going to Sears.
Oh, gosh. Yeah,
family
they had everything.
Pictures.
Lawnmowers, tools, you name it.
Some clothes. Yeah, it was great going to Sears.
Fun.
The two hung out and soon realized they would be attending the same college. The relationship eventually turned serious, and the two became college sweethearts. Mark and Julie seemed like a bit of an odd match. Julie was kind and smart, and everybody loved her. And Mark was ambitious and driven, always trying to keep up with the Joneses. He wanted more than what everyone else had.
That's fair.
He was very into appearances, and Julie was just bubbly and sweet, and everybody loved Julie. And I know we say this about victims all the time, but no one ever had anything bad to say about Julie. She was wonderful. Her brothers, of which she had five brothers, called her their angel.
Wow.
Yeah. So this is going to be horrific.
So angel and demon.
Well, we'll see. Before graduating from college, the couple were married on April 15th, 1984. Mark eventually became a stockbroker, and Julie, who did not officially graduate from college, worked as an administrative assistant to a stockbroker. She even had her Series 7 license, mm-hmm. which meant that she could place orders for customers.
Yep.
So this chick was smart.
So the Series 7 is kind of like borderline taking the bar to be a lawyer. Only it's for financial institutions.
Yeah. So are we picturing Julie?
She's a smart thing.
She's a smart, for sure. Little petite blonde, just sweet as pie.
But he's smart too. Julie.
He's very smart.
Yeah.
Mark is very smart, but he's kind of swarmy, like somebody called you.
Sure. Swarmy. I still don't know what that means. But
I don't know what that means.
I can't help but draw the parallel to this period of time.
Okay.
This was about the time that the Wolf of Wall Street started.
Oh, okay.
So I believe he started in 84-ish, kind of. If you watch the movie and they sort of kind of follow what actually happened.
Right.
For those of you that haven't seen the movie.
It's just hookers and blow.
Yeah, don't watch it
the whole time.
Don't watch it with your 10-year-olds. But anyway,
I don't know about Mark being into hookers and blow, but you never know.
I'm just saying that this was a time in the 80s when the whole stock market scene was just really going. And it's kind of like everyone was in real estate in 2004.
But everybody was a stockbroker in 1984.
Correct.
Yeah, that
everything
makes sense.
Was really starting to churn.
To family, friends, and coworkers, the couple seemed happy. And in 1990, 6 years into the marriage, Julie gave birth to their first son. According to close friends and family members, after the baby's arrival, the cracks in the Jensen's marriage began to grow. Mark was a hard worker and had very little time to devote to Julie and the new baby. He seemed to kind of leave the child rearing and housekeeping only to Julie. She was the only caregiver to the baby.
So she didn't feel overwhelmed at all.
Oh, no, not at all. And she was continuing to work.
Wow.
But Mark liked to have an opinion on everything Julie was doing within the home and with the baby, criticizing her at every turn. Yeah, he's a POS for sure.
So his job took him longer than her job? Is that his justification for not being able to do anything else but just his job?
Yes, and because he was ambitious.
Okay.
But Julie liked that in the beginning. But then once they had the baby, she realized that that was all he liked to do.
Okay.
Was to work. But I also want to remind all of you and me and Daniel that we don't know these people. We don't personally know these people. So I'm just getting information from all the hopefully credible sources that I went through. So I don't know this for sure, but this is just the general gist of what I was getting from people.
Sure. It is easy to armchair quarterback.
Absolutely. Armchair investigate.
Or that.
Armchair judge.
You name it. All that stuff from the armchair. We got armchairs now on our chairs.
we got
arms on our chairs.
During this time, Julie felt unloved and unappreciated. And she was still working full time and soon began a friendship with another new parent at her office.
Sure.
A man by the name of Perry Tarica. His wife had also just had a baby, and he and Julie bonded over this new chapter in their lives. They also talked about their relationship troubles with their spouses.
Perfect.
Ooh, bonding over relationship issues with your spouses is probably not a good idea.
Oh, you're not supposed to do that?
No. And having a new baby is hard, and it's hard on a marriage. We can agree with that, can't we?
Yeah. So he's lonely because his wife just had a baby.
Right.
And he's at work. She's lonely because she just had a baby and her husband's not helping. So she's not exactly really super into her husband right now.
No.
And so on and so forth. So they turned to each other from their significant others.
And they probably wanted to make sure that what they were feeling was normal.
Sure.
And instead of talking to their spouses, they talked to each other, which is always never a good idea. In early 1991, Mark had left town for the weekend, and Julie thought it was a good idea to have Perry over for dinner.
Absolutely it is not.
One thing led to another, and the two co-workers became intimate.
Well, she did invite him over for dinner, which is code for
no, it's not.
An aerobics class.
Perry stayed at Julie's house for the entire weekend. And immediately Julie felt guilty for her indiscretions and admitted to the brief affair with Mark.
Well, there was her mistake.
Told him as soon as he got home what had happened. And Mark was furious.
Of course he was.
He could not believe that Julie would ever cheat on him. Julie also quit her job come Monday morning.
Okay.
So she walked in there and quit. And she never saw Perry again.
So in your opinion... Okay, so she humps Perry all weekend long. Her annoying husband finally comes home from his trip, walks in the door. She goes, "Hi, honey, how was your trip?" "Good. How was your weekend?" "Good. Yeah, so,
I need to tell you something.
I kind of humped a guy all weekend here at the house. I had an adult aerobics all weekend long. So, yeah, it's just kind of been bothering me, and I thought I'd let you know."
She was just honest, and I think it would have eaten her alive had she not said something to Mark. But
she also did it. So it didn't bother her that much.
I think she was just looking for physical touch and affection and somebody to tell her that she's beautiful and she's doing a good job. I mean, you crave that as a woman and as a new mom and a wife. So somebody other than her husband was saying all the right things.
And then Perry probably was feeling, well... Let's be honest. His wife just had a baby, so it's not like they're intimate, you know.
Possibly. I don't really know what was going on
more than likely not
relationship.
So then he's basically they're each getting from each other what they're both kind of needing at the moment.
Right. Or what he's saying he's not getting at home. Maybe he just wanted to get in Julie's pants.
Sure.
So he was telling her all the right things to get her naked.
Okay.
I mean, you never know. I don't know for sure. About 6 months after the less than 48-hour affair and 7 years into the marriage, Julie filed for divorce because she just couldn't take it anymore.
Yeah.
Mark was livid. He told Julie that if she went through with it, he would, quote unquote, crush her.
What?
He would tell the court about her infidelity, make Julie look crazy, and that he would get full custody of their son and she would never see him again. So Julie withdrew her divorce petition.
Okay, so at that point, she should have called the best divorce lawyer she could find and said, "All right, here's what happened. Here's what I did. Here's what he just threatened me with. What should I do?"
But at this time, infidelity was such a huge deal breaker when it came to divorces that all you had to do was have any sort of proof and you were the person coming out on top. I mean, we're talking about the 90s, especially if you're a woman and you cheated on your husband. Woo! That was horrible.
I guess. I don't know. It's not like 1952, though.
No, but it was still not fair.
Okay.
In my opinion, the 90s were still not fair.
It wasn't fair. Okay.
No. In that sort of sense with divorces and things like that and custody. Yeah.
So in her opinion, it was too much of a risk, so she withdrew the whole divorce thing. Except now he knows she ultimately wants to leave him.
Right.
And she's miserable.
But he's not doing anything to make her want to stay. But I think he just didn't want to look bad. He didn't want this perfect little family that he had created, even though behind closed doors it was awful. He didn't want people to know that. He wanted to look like this perfect picture on the mantle. Within weeks after Julie had filed for divorce and then withdrew her petition, pornographic images of what appeared to be Julie with an unidentified man began appearing on Mark and Julie's cars, around the outside of their home, in their mailbox, even in their neighbor's mailboxes, on Mark's car at the office, and some even making their way inside the home.
Oh, wow.
So these images never really showed a full face, but it showed the hair. It looked like a woman doing something with a man's appendage. They always kind of looked like Julie, but you never really saw the face and you never saw the man's face. You just saw his weenus.
Gotcha. So what's the point then if it isn't clearly her?
But it kind of looked like her. And Julie didn't know for sure if it wasn't her.
Yeah, but someone photographed her.
Right. Right.
In the throes of aerobics class.
With Perry.
But you can't tell it's Perry. And you can't tell it's her.
Right.
So that...
I know. Someone even started calling the Jensen home and hanging up when they would answer. Eventually, Mark and Julie had enough. These photos were being used to taunt Mark and degrade Julie, so the couple finally went to the authorities. The only person Mark and Julie thought could be doing this was Julie's ex-coworker, Perry. That's the only person they thought could be doing it.
But she broke it off with Perry.
And so Perry was mad, so he was trying to get back at her.
Yeah,
because he wanted to be with her.
But he's still married to his wife.
I believe at this time he was still married to his wife.
Okay.
An investigator questioned Perry about the accusations, and he denied any involvement in the photos and the phone calls. Without any proof, Perry was given a warning and told never to contact Julie or Mark again. So what does Perry do? He writes Julie a love note and mails it to her.
What?
He wrote that he loved Julie and wanted her to leave Mark. Perry did admit to doing this, and he was given a citation by the police.
What an idiot.
In the fall of 1998, Perry moved to New York City, but the porn photos and hang-up calls never stopped. Isn't that weird?
That is weird.
Police concluded that it couldn't have been Perry torturing Julie and Mark. It had to be someone else, someone who could get inside of their home. Because remember, those photos are also being found in the home.
So someone somehow is accessing the inside of their home.
Yes.
Leaving stuff, but nothing's taken. It's not like they robbed them.
No. It was just to taunt Mark and to degrade Julie.
Wow.
Julie kept a logbook of the events and called the police on a regular basis, complaining about the harassment. So the police knew Julie because of this.
Gotcha.
In 1995, Julie gave birth to the couple's second son, and Mark became even more controlling.
Oh, that's weird.
Trying to isolate Julie from her family and friends, he checked her mileage on her car regularly and made her carry the cordless phone around the house with her so that she had no excuse not to answer the phone when he called. This was not a good situation for Julie, but she was trapped in a toxic marriage. And she still loved Mark.
What's to love?
I don't know, but everyone kept saying she just loved him.
Why?
I don't know.
See, okay.
I'm so sorry.
It drives me nuts.
I know.
I hear people are like, but I still loved him. Why? What about that is lovable?
I think because you create this life and you create this family with somebody, and at one point you had to have loved them to do that with them. So you're still kind of living in the past. You're still kind of living within those feelings. But there has to come a time when you're like, love does not conquer all. What's love got to do with it? Right, Tina Turner?
I guess. I think she loved the idea of the perfect life.
I think they both did.
And that's what she loved. That maybe that's possible still. But him personally, why would she love him?
I don't know. Because he really wasn't even that cute.
Well, and he doesn't trust her.
No.
And I don't, I mean, okay, so she cheated on him. So why would he trust her, right?
That's right.
Fair.
But I get that. But he also has to look internally and look at what he was doing during that time too.
Yeah. But gosh, I wonder why she couldn't stand to be around me and wanted to be with someone else.
But I think she did want to be around him and she did want to be with him. He just didn't want to be with her. He chose his job over being with her.
Yeah.
A couple days after Julie's death, one of the investigators was given a sealed envelope and a film canister by the couple who lived next door to the Jensens. Julie had given them the envelope and film 10 days before her death.
Uh-oh.
Telling them to give the package to the police if something were to ever happen to her. The couple kept their promise and stored the items in a cabinet. Inside the envelope was a handwritten letter, a sort of last testament. The film was developed and there was one picture of a small handwritten list. Julie had discovered something as she was cleaning the den that scared her to death. And I'm going to read this to you.
Okay.
Are you ready for this?
I'm ready.
Pleasant Prairie Police Department, Ron Kosman or Detective Ratzenberg. I took this picture and I'm writing this on Saturday, November 21st, 1998 at 7 a.m. This quote unquote list was in my husband's business daily planner, not meant for me to see. I don't know what it means, but if anything happens to me, he would be my first suspect. Our relationship has deteriorated to the polite superficial. I know he's never forgiven me for the brief affair I had with that creep 7 years ago. Mark lives for work and the kids. He's an avid surfer on the internet. Anyway, I do not smoke or drink. My mother was an alcoholic, so I limit my drinking to one or two a week. Mark wants me to drink more with him in the evenings. I don't. I would never take my life because of my kids. They are everything to me. I regularly take Tylenol and multivitamins, occasionally take OTC stuff for colds, meaning over-the-counter stuff for colds, Zantac or Imodium, have one prescription for migraine tablets, which Mark uses more than I. I pray I'm wrong and nothing happens, but I am suspicious of Mark's suspicious behaviors and fear for my early demise. However, I will not leave her two kids' names, my life's greatest love, accomplishment, and wish, my three Ds, Daddy, which meant Mark, and the two sons' names, which started with D's, Julie C. Jensen.
So she had a pretty good idea that something was going to happen to her bad.
She did.
But she didn't want to get out?
She didn't want to be wrong.
Yeah, but worst case scenario, if she's wrong, she still got out. She didn't want to be there anyway.
True, but if you're, I mean, how low do you have to be in your marriage to believe that your husband wants to kill you?
That's what I'm saying. If at that point she thinks that that might happen, I would say, I don't care what he does with a divorce attorney. I'm getting out. Live to fight another day, right?
Yeah.
Especially if you have some sort of proof or get a private investigator to help prove your case and bounce.
True. And if you are really feeling like your husband's going to hurt you, then you also need to get out for your two kids and take them as far away as you possibly can.
Yep.
There was also a photo of a list of things that Mark needed to get, which included syringes or own drug supply or bag hands, which I don't really know what bag hands means, but it was a list and they call it a kill list because it was all these things that you would need to kind of murder somebody in that way. The Jensen family computer was analyzed and hidden deep within the history, they found some stuff. Someone within that home had been searching for different poisons and certain prescription drug interactions and overdoses starting in October of 1998. On November 29th at 5:21 a.m., someone accessed a site about antifreeze.
Okay.
On December 2nd at 6:23 a.m., the day before Julie died, someone looked up a site called ethylene glycol. 13 minutes later, an additional internet site was accessed on the subject of ethylene glycol and its toxic effects and stages. That same night at 10:47 p.m., another site was accessed called antifreeze poisoning. So after seeing all of that, the investigators were like, oh my gosh, he must have killed her with ethylene glycol.
Sure.
Antifreeze or ethylene glycol is not typically caught in your average autopsy. They just don't look for it all the time. So samples from Julie's original autopsy were immediately sent to the toxicologist. It was also discovered on that computer that Mark had been having an affair with a coworker. The emails between them were found on the computer's hard drive, deep within that hard drive. Her name was Kelly Labonte.
Wait a minute.
Every time I say her name, I want to go, Kelly Labonte.
So he's a big hypocrite.
He was then.
Although.
He wasn't cheating on Julie for years. This has just happened right before her
so
death.
Maybe in his mind, he's like, you know what? I'm justified. She got to do it. Why can't I?
Right.
So, yeah, that's fair, I guess.
Well, Kelly Labonte was an associate of Mark's at the brokerage firm. Well, Kelly was the, well, she was the complete opposite of Julie. So I kept picturing them as Sandy and Rizzo from Grease.
Sure.
These, like, the good angel and then, I don't know if she's a devil. Kelly's not a devil, but, like, she was definitely.
Everything Julie wasn't.
Everything Julie wasn't. Gotcha. She was voluptuous and sexual and funny and liked to hang out with the guys. And Julie was like the sweet angel mom.
Yeah.
You know? According to the criminal complaint that I found against Mark, he and Kelly began exchanging flirty emails on September 3rd after a business trip that the two were on where they finally participated in adult aerobics for the first time.
It's always on those business trips.
It is. St. Louis, man. What happens in St. Louis? Maybe stays in St. Louis.
You know, for anyone listening who has a spouse that does go on business trips, I'm really sorry. Because there's no way you're not now thinking in the back of your mind, is he really going on a business trip? Or she? I don't know. Is she going on a business trip? Because it seems like these kind of situations, that's when it happens.
That's when stuff happens. Things go down. We have friends that have had things happen on business trips. Just saying.
Gosh, I got to go on another business trip. You just went on a business trip. Oh, I know. It's just really tough at work right now. So I got to go on another business trip.
I probably have to cut that part out where I call out our friends.
Yeah, don't say that.
All right. So Mark says in one of his emails, thank you. Wish I hadn't been so tired. So little sleep the previous night. Was great just hanging out. Definitely lucky. Got a few looks and questions about being in St. Louis. Cute. All covered. Then Ron called. It was about Columbus. Just funny the way it flowed. Hey, came in this morning and my blinds were up. And I do like those knobs. Idly. Cheers. That's stupid.
That's weird.
Okay, so from Kelly, she says, when I heard Marcia say you were on the phone for Ron, I was all ears, but not too concerned. It was funny, though. You have knobs on your blinds? Question mark. There must have been some hidden little meaning about knobs.
Probably.
Then Mark writes back, wouldn't mind knobs on my blinds. Would prefer cheeks on my desk. Cheers. Did you smile?
Cheeks on his desk.
Barf.
Got it.
Then Kelly answers, if you continue being a good boy, maybe you'll get what you wish for. I would enjoy participating. Yes, I smiled. I always smile when talking to you. Gross.
Fun.
Oh, well, good for you guys.
She seems like a fun girl.
She seems
to have around the office.
She did seem like she was fun. Okay. But guess what?
What?
Kelly had just gotten married days before this business trip.
What?
Yeah.
Why?
I don't know. Why, Kelly? Why did you get married if you knew you were going to bang Mark eventually? Because they were flirty at the office, too. So, I mean, this is how it was going down.
What's the point?
Well, after this initial email, they became more and more flirty and sexually provocative.
Well, because they had already worked in the out emails. Together.
Right.
Yeah.
Mark became obsessed with Kelly. Once he had her, he would not let her go. Mark even began asking Kelly intimate questions about her former sexual partners, asking her about their wieners. He was writing their stats down in a notebook and even drawing them out, comparing himself to these drawings of past lovers of Kelly's.
All right, that's weird.
He was like obsessed with their penises. So
he was very insecure?
Yes.
I'm guessing?
He had a whole notebook full of wieners, drawn out wieners, and their names and then what Kelly had said about them sexually.
Okay.
Yeah. All right. Yeah.
A book of wieners. All right. Fair enough. Why not?
It reminds me of the movie Superbad when he says that he would draw wieners everywhere.
There. Yeah. Only this is the real thing. This that is was real. A movie. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay.
Incidentally, the porn photos and hang-up calls stopped around the time Mark and Kelly's affair began.
Huh.
One email between the adulterers, because they're both adulterers, really stood out to investigators. On October 16th, Kelly and Mark were emailing one another about leaving their spouses and how they needed to clean up their lives. Kelly said she was just going to divorce her husband, but Mark didn't say anything back. And later that night, someone in the Jensen home began looking up poisons and botulism and low acid canned foods for the very first time. Was this a coincidence?
Botulism and low acid canned foods.
Yeah, they actually think that that was Julie that looked up the botulism.
Okay.
But that it was Mark who was looking up poisons, obviously.
Okay.
Also found in that computer were around 2,800 pictures of penises.
Saved?
Yeah, on the computer.
Goodness, that's a significant amount.
And they were put into categories by large, medium, and favorites. Now, this was not Julie's doing. She did not go on the internet and find pictures of penises and catalog them.
Maybe he wants to become a urologist.
Maybe. Or maybe he was just insecure, like you said.
Hmm.
The toxicology report came back on the samples taken of Julie's stomach. Her stomach contents, kidneys, blood, and urine all had high amounts of ethylene glycol. There was a significant formation of oxalic acid crystals in Julie's kidneys.
You want to hear the good news?
What?
She can't freeze to death.
Oh, God, Daniel.
Sorry.
In her blood, the presence of ethylene glycol was at 55 micrograms per milliliter. There were 720 micrograms per milliliter in her urine and 3,094 micrograms per milliliter in the stomach contents. So Julie Jensen died as a result of poisoning with ethylene glycol.
That's a lot. It's a lot of antifreeze.
It was. All right, I'm going to read to you what the forensic toxicologist said in one of his reports.
Okay.
Ethylene glycol was the cause of death in Miss Jensen. The pathology shows crystals in the kidneys and the toxicology demonstrates ethylene glycol. This compound was identified in the blood and large amounts were found in the stomach contents. There is no other reasonable explanation for Miss Jensen's death. Miss Jensen did not die from a single administration of ethylene glycol. The concentration in her blood was low, but the tissues had crystals. These crystals demonstrate that she survived the initial phase of ethylene glycol poisoning. The stomach, having a large concentration of ethylene glycol, demonstrates an acute ingestion at or near the time of death. The crystals in the tissue define the first dose at more than 12 hours earlier, and the stomach concentration defines the second or final dose at her death. The autopsy testing shows that there were at least two doses of ethylene glycol, and this is further supported by her history. This appears to be a homicide for the following reasons. Reason number one, the ethylene glycol was not present in the house. Number two, her stomach contained significant amounts of ethylene glycol, showing her death occurred at or near the time of administration. Number three, Ms. Jensen would have been too weak to drink the volume of ethylene glycol found in her stomach at autopsy without help. Number four, Ms. Jensen would have been too weak to hide the ethylene glycol after her final dose. Number five, multiple doses were administered. And finally, her letter 10 days before her death. This is a case of ethylene glycol poisoning with a fatal result. The chemical was administered at least two times prior to her death, which is inconsistent with a suicide. Boom.
Yeah.
There are three stages to an ethylene glycol poisoning. The first stage is when the person feels inebriated. The second stage is difficulty breathing, rapid pulse rate, and vomiting. The third is you start forming oxalate crystals in your organs, especially the kidneys. The medical examiner also believed that Julie may have been asphyxiated as well.
Mm-hmm.
Mark finally came in for a formal interview in April of 1999, a few months after Julie's death. By the time of this interview, Kelly had divorced her new husband and had moved in with Mark and the two boys. They were now a happy family. Which was fine because Mark had filled 10 to 15 black trash bags with Julie's belongings and put the bags out on the curb for waste management only days after she had died. So there was enough room in the closets and dresser for Kelly. So that worked out good.
No, that makes sense.
Mark was first asked about the pornography photos that were being plastered around the house and in the mail. He admitted to being the one who was psychologically torturing Julie. Yeah. Which the police had actually concluded many months before her murder when they told the couple that they would no longer be responding to the complaints. And they even told Julie, or a private investigator told Julie, I think it's Mark doing this, and she would not believe it.
It makes sense.
It does.
Yeah.
Mark said that he would pull the copies of the images out and place them around so she would find them when she would piss him off. That's exactly what he said, when she'd make him mad.
God.
Mark was asked to go over the days leading up to Julie's death. He talked about her doctor's visit, the new medication, her reaction, and eventual death. The detective then told Mark that they believed he was the only one that could have killed her and that he poisoned Julie with ethylene glycol. Without skipping a beat, the investigator sitting across from Mark slips the letter in front of him and then leaves the room to go get a soda. Mark stared wide-eyed at that piece of paper without moving for almost 4 minutes.
Oh, boy.
Just staring at her last will and testament, basically, her last words alive. He denied having anything to do with Julie's death. And without any physical evidence, they had to let him go. Now, in 2002, Bob was reading the local paper and saw a picture of Mark and Kelly announcing their engagement. He knew he needed to act fast. And Bob said in one of the interviews that he was worried that Kelly was going to be next. When he was done with his new plaything, he would kill her next, which I don't think that that's true. I think he was just wanting to get rid of Julie. But that's just my opinion.
All right. So I have a question.
Yes.
Doesn't it seem odd that the investigators would essentially show their hand knowing that they couldn't arrest him?
I think they were hoping that he would just break down and admit to it.
Like they were kind of bluffing to see if he would go, fine, okay, right. I admit it, I killed her.
Right. But he didn't.
All right.
With only circumstantial evidence at best, Mark Jensen was arrested. Mark was able to post a $500,000 cash bond and then was let out of prison or out of jail. During a pre-trial hearing, a judge ruled that Julie's letter was inadmissible in court because the accused has a right to confront their accuser. The case could not move forward without Julie's letter, is what they were feeling. In the years that follow, Mark married Kelly. They moved into a new house, Mark started a successful construction company, and they also had a kid. So life went on without Julie.
Wow.
In 2007, the prosecutor petitioned the court for a hearing to decide if the letter is now admissible in trial. They were waiting for another trial that had been going on to see what that verdict ended up being and whether or not they could use that to possibly get the law changed in Wisconsin that you could use, you know, last words from somebody
so
that
as
died.
So as the result of another trial,
right.
That trial could possibly set precedence.
Exactly.
And with that precedence, they could then move forward with saying, okay, look,
right.
This is why we think we need to allow it here. And then they'd be like, oh, okay, fine.
And it was allowed in another case. So then they petitioned to see if the letter was now admissible in the trial. And this judge now said that there was sufficient evidence that Mark was responsible for the death of his wife, Julie, and that it was Mark who was responsible for Julie being unable to testify. So the judge ruled that Julie's letter was now admissible in court. And there was also a new witness who had come forward. Mark's co-worker named Ed Klug. The two were at a business conference and started drinking together at the hotel bar. The drink started flowing and so did the conversation. Both men started talking about the issues they were having in their marriage, except Mark went deep. He said that he hated Julie and that he could kill her. He told Ed that there were websites about poisons that could be used. And even went into detail about what he had found. Ed thought it was weird, but thought Mark was just blowing smoke. And this was only 3 weeks before Julie died.
Okay, here's a weird question.
Okay.
Not weird. He could have gotten out of the marriage because she wanted to divorce him.
Ding, ding.
So why would he insist on staying married only to later want to get out of the marriage?
We'll talk about motive in a little bit.
Okay.
When asked why it took him so long to come forward, Ed said that he was scared and didn't want to get involved. And then Mark was sent to prison to await trial because they tripled his bond after that.
Okay, so he's now remarried to Kelly Kelly, has a kid with her, still has the other two kids. The other kids probably by now know there's a rumor that their mom's dead because of their dad.
Yeah, this was
There's
10 years
no
later.
No way they don't know that.
They're 18 and 13.
Oh, God. Okay. All right.
Well,
Perfect.
On January 7th, 2008, Mark was tried for the murder of his wife, Julie. He pled not guilty. The defense said that Julie was suicidal and that she purposely framed Mark for her death because she had found out about his affair with Kelly. No.
But she wanted
Not
to leave
true.
Him.
Exactly. So when people kill themselves with antifreeze, there's usually massive amounts of liquid in their stomachs because they drink a large amount at once, and then that's it. It's not drawn out for 3 days.
Yeah, there's. What's the point? Why would you want to slowly kill yourself?
Right. Now, she had a lot in her stomach, but it wasn't a huge glass full like they find in suicide victims. Plus, there was never a bottle of antifreeze that was found or a cup filled with traces of the liquid. So if she had done this to herself, she was too weak to clean up the evidence.
Gotcha.
So where was it? Where was the evidence?
Yeah, because
right?
immediately her body would reject it.
Right.
And she wouldn't then go like whistling a tune, listening to a podcast with earbuds in,
cleaning
everything
kitchen.
Up.
Right.
Yeah, throwing stuff away, making sure the trash is taken out. There's no way. Zero chance of that. Yeah.
So that was what they were saying, is that she killed herself to frame Mark.
Okay. Sure.
The state had an interesting witness, a man who was cellmates with Mark for a few days. He said that he was able to get Mark talking, and Mark did admit to poisoning Julie with antifreeze in cups of juice over the course of a few days, but that she wasn't dying, so he rolled her on her side from her back, buried her face in the pillow, and sat on her back.
Yeah.
Asphyxiating so Julie.
Suffocated her.
Yeah. Mark told the jailhouse snitch that he had to do it before the boys got home from school because he had told them that if mommy was still sick when they got home, they would take her to the hospital.
Okay.
Julie's letter was read in court to the jury, which was really the heart of the case. This was Julie's own words. The case then went to the jury on February 1st. After deliberating for 3 days, the jury came back with a guilty verdict. Mark was sentenced to life in prison. But ladies and gentlemen, and Daniel, this case does not end there.
Okay.
In 2013, a United States district judge overturned the conviction, saying that the letter should never have been admitted into evidence because it violated Mark's Sixth Amendment, the right to confront the witness against him, and ordered Mark's release from prison. The state appealed, pausing Mark's release from prison.
Wait, okay, but how could he ever stand trial for his wife's death if she's dead? Because they're charging him.
It's all about the letter. It's all about whether or not the letter should be admitted into evidence used in the court.
Because the letter is accusatory, but the person who wrote the letter is the accuser, is not available. All right, I guess. Interesting.
Yeah, because Mark can't confront her about what she wrote.
Okay. I sort of see that in that you could write anything.
Right.
And then die. Right.
And then. Yeah. And then the person that you accuse cannot confront you about that.
Right. Right. All right. Fair enough.
The Court of Appeals affirmed the lower court's decision in September of 2015, ruling that the state improperly used evidence. But in 2017, a Kenosha County judge found that Julie's letter was not considered testimonial, so he canceled Mark's retrial and affirmed the original conviction. Mark was once again found guilty of murdering Julie. Mark's defense team immediately began appealing his second conviction. After many, many appeals in March of 2021, the Wisconsin Supreme Court ruled that the letter could not be used as evidence during the trial and ordered a retrial for Mark.
Oh my gosh.
63-year-old Mark Jensen's new trial began in January of 2023 without Julie's letter. Mark was still found guilty for a third time in February.
What?
Oh, Wisconsin, aren't you glad you paid for all of this? Just saying. He was recently sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole again.
Okay. Unless, of course, they appeal it.
Okay. Well, motive. Let's talk about motive.
Yeah.
So they're saying Mark did not want to divorce Julie because it would mess up his life. Especially his finances, because divorces cost money. And then there's alimony and child support. So this is all about money that Mark did not want to give Julie.
So if he just gets her to leave permanently, but be dead,
right,
then he doesn't have to do anything.
Nothing.
He can just move in a new woman.
Yeah. And he can keep his kids. He can keep his money.
Yeah, God, but that's, I don't know. That's quite a risk.
Yeah, but he thought he was smarter than everybody else.
Just to avoid a divorce?
It comes down to him thinking that he's smarter than everybody else.
Well, no, absolutely.
All right, fun fact. Daniel, you ready for a fun fact?
I guess.
Mark's ex-wife, Kelly, testified against him in both his 2008 and 2023 trials. She said that Mark never told her about his plans to kill Julie. If he had, she never would have continued the relationship. But Kelly divorced Mark after he was arrested the first time. Kelly kept primary custody of all three of Mark's children. So she helped to raise the boys.
Wow.
Even while Mark was in prison, even while she was divorced from Mark, which I think actually says a lot about Kelly.
Does.
And I hope she's doing well. I really do. I know she's remarried, and I hope that she was able to be the mom that the boys needed at that time.
Man, that's complicated. So she divorced the guy she just got married to while sleeping with Mark, then divorced Mark, then got remarried but raised his kids. It's just, God.
It's a lot. It's
too much.
Mm-hmm. And we all think we have confusing lives.
Okay, no, but people don't. Say, oh, I have such a tough life. I'm sorry you brought this on yourself.
Ooh.
Life didn't happen to you. You created this.
Are you talking about Kelly?
Yeah. Oh. Absolutely. I mean, okay, I'm but glad she's raising the kids.
She didn't know she was marrying a murderer.
She cheated on her new husband with Mark. Right away.
I'm sure that's a huge regret, and she never should have married that guy ever. If you are getting married, but you're thinking about banging this other dude, please don't get married. Yeah, save your money. Just
call it off. I don't know.
All right. Mark and Julie's eldest son, who was now 33, he also testified. He remembered saying goodbye to his mom before leaving for school. She gave her boys a hug from bed and in a raspy voice told them that she loved them. The son said that he remembers Mark saying that if Julie was still sick when they got home from school, he would take her to the hospital, matching what that cellmate had said in court.
Huh.
That he had to do it before the boys got home so that he wouldn't have to take her to the hospital.
Yeah.
Isn't that sad? Ugh. All right, Daniel, what did you think of my case?
People create awfully complicated lives.
Don't they?
They really do. Well, these people did. I don't know.
I don't know what the point was.
Yeah.
What was the point, Mark?
So much work.
Now you're in prison staring at lots of wieners.
Maybe.
In person.
It's like, can I see your wiener?
It's so funny
Look at mine. Because
you read about this information and you watch shows about the information, and all of them are always delving into this whole penis infatuation, right? And then you watch these kind of higher end shows like 2020 or Dateline, and they never mention the penis thing ever.
Even though that was a big part of it.
It really was.
Well, in his case, it was a small part of it. But you get what I'm saying.
Well, they were just trying to show his mental state, I think, during this time. Like, why would a grown man have 2,800 pictures of penises on his home computer? Why? And why would you categorize them? Not all the lights were on at home, I guess. What's one of those sayings?
Sure. The lights were on, but nobody was home.
Kind of.
Not all the stairs led to the top floor.
Yeah. Not all the rockets were firing.
Part of the escalators were broken going to the top of the building where the brain.
Something was going on with him for sure. Mm-hmm. Well, did you find it interesting?
It's very interesting.
Okay. Well, my information came from a million articles. There's so much information on this case. That's a lot of articles. And I did watch the newest 2020 episode. And then there was a brand new Dateline episode that came out just a couple days ago. I watched it with our nice friend's Hulu account.
Perfect.
And Going West also covered this case in their podcast. And we all know how much I love Going West. So, you know, I got to give them a shout out.
Well, we can't go much farther.
Speaking of shout outs, Daniel, let's do some Patreon shout outs.
Okie dokie.
Here's the list right here for you.
Thanks again for supporting our humble little show. Melissa really works very hard, and clearly I do not. So thank you very much. Erica W. Thanks, Erica. Delta W. We got two W's.
Yeah.
Thanks, Delta. Alicia. Thanks.
Alicia.
What did I say? Alicia. I'm sorry. Alicia. Thanks, Alicia. Lauren G. Kind of like Warren G. Except for not at all. Thanks, Lauren. And Kathy F. Thanks, Kathy. We really appreciate you guys. Thank you so much.
We really do. Thank you so much for helping to support the show, this crazy manic show. We appreciate you.
Hey, speak for yourself. I am not manic, but crazy.
If you are enjoying our show, please go rate and review us on Apple Podcasts or Spotify. It really helps us get noticed. We only do one form of social media, and that's on Instagram at Till Death Do Us Part Podcast. And that's it. So be careful.
For marriage is a life sentence.
And divorce is always the better option, Mark.
As is displayed in this episode.
All right. Bye.
Bye-bye.